You're listening to the Crowdfunding Nerds Podcast, a podcast that will help you succeed before, during, and after your crowdfunding event. And now, here is your host, Andrew Lowen.
Hey, what's up, nerds? This is the first official Crowdfunding Nerds episode. I am your chief nerd, Andrew Lowen, and I am joined by my team, Rick, the SEO marketing wizard, and sexy Irish Sean. How are you guys doing?
Sexy nerd, can that be a thing?
I mean, it's 2020. Anything can be a thing.
I've always loved being a wizard. I like, you know, magic and Dungeons and Dragons, so I think it's right up my alley.
That's what clients think you do. They have no idea what SEO marketing actually is. They think you basically walk into a cave, roll a stone over it, and then put on your robe and wizard hat and do magic somehow that gets them ranked.
It's magic.
They only really start caring after like the first 6 months of work. They're like, okay, what are you doing besides charging my credit card? All right, so we are talking about a couple of things today. The first thing is Mike Nade over at Rock Manor Games wrote an article back in October talking about Kickstarter referral metrics and generally trying to just explain them. And I thought that article was great. It was actionable data that I, as a marketer, really, really love. So what I thought we would do is write a, I don't want to say a response, but a continuation of that with our clients. We've worked with, in the last year, 22 different Kickstarter campaigns that have raised a combined about $2 million of funding. And I believe 17 or 18 of those were for first-time creators. And so I thought that this article was really cool. It provided an excellent type of insight. Anyone who is going into a Kickstarter campaign or actually for the very seasoned Kickstarter creators, this should be very useful to go deeper down that rabbit hole. So that's the first half of what we're going to talk about. And then the second half is really, when should you crowdfund and when is it wrong? Over the last year, when we really started offering crowdfunding as a service in our marketing agency, I have turned many clients away, many prospective clients away. And the reason for that is because I really felt that they weren't ready to go to Kickstarter. They weren't ready, number one, for the success that comes with Kickstarter, or they weren't ready for the actual toxicity or backers looking at their project, or maybe their actual product wasn't quite there yet. And so we want to talk about when should you crowdfund and when is it wrong to go to crowdfunding, or when are you ready, when are you not ready? So all that said, Sean, you want to kick us off with that Rock Manor Games article?
Sure. So yeah, we came across this article by Rock Manor Games by Mike Nade. It was quite in depth. He followed his own campaign and essentially we're trying to answer the question, what is the return on investment for your efforts when it comes to a Kickstarter campaign? How much can we attribute to our own inputs, our own efforts, our advertising, our organic reach, and how much can be directly attributed to Kickstarter itself as a platform? You know, we could all recognize that you don't just push a product on Kickstarter, sit back, relax, and let Kickstarter do all the magic, and boom, you know, you have an instant success. I think everyone who approaches Kickstarter recognizes that there is some type of user input that is necessary. What we found was that the referrals that Kickstarter produces at the end of a campaign are a little misleading, or maybe they're insufficient and they aren't very helpful. So we wanted to do a deep dive into seeing what is the exact percentage of, you know, what we can attribute to ourselves and what we can attribute to Kickstarter. So that's what we sought to do.
That's awesome. Yeah, the basic premise of the article is that Mike Nade had a Kickstarter campaign that they did called Set a Watch, Swords of the Coin. And they raised a total of, you know, low $200,000 amount. And Kickstarter attributed 72% of that, which was about 160 grand, was pledged via Kickstarter, meaning Kickstarter takes credit for that. Kickstarter has all of these in-depth referral sources that, you know, might come from the Kickstarter platform, like discovery or, you know, recommendations, or, you know, just things that are titled advanced discovery, discovery recommendations, etc. And it gives you external referrers, which would be things like Facebook. You know, somebody clicked through, you know, you have a Facebook group, somebody clicks through a link from your Facebook group to your Kickstarter campaign and then backs your campaign. It's going to, you know, add a backer from Facebook, which is an external source. And then there's a third little category called custom referrers. For those that don't know, you can create a custom link that would, you know, let's say if you were running Facebook ads or something, you would want to figure out what, you know, percentage of your funding was raised via Facebook ads, you would create one of these custom links and then use that in all your ads. And then you would know generally what percentage of people came in via Facebook ads, right? And so those would be custom refers. So Kickstarter likes to take credit for 60 to 70% of the funding for your campaign. We kind of found, rather, this article kind of found that it was more like at the extreme end, it was actually more like 75% of the work that he did was directly, or of the funding they got was directly attributable to the work that he did versus what Kickstarter was able to bring to the table. So it was more like 75-25. Kickstarter was responsible for about 25% of that funding. We decided to use several of our own clients as case studies using the same methodology. So what we did was we separated all of the referral sources that Kickstarter lists, and there were pages of referral sources for each of our campaigns, and we decided to separate them into three different categories based off of what the original article on Rock Manor Games did. So number one, the first category is 100% of the people in this category absolutely, without a doubt, discovered your project on Kickstarter. This would be something like advanced discovery or recommendations. People, you know, were pointed to your project. Then the next category that the Rock Manor Games article talks about is debatable. So if somebody does a search on Kickstarter, that is considered debatable because maybe they heard about your project from a friend. Maybe it was from the Facebook ad you did. Maybe it was from a, you know, whatever it was, a Board Game Geek conversation. And then they went on to Kickstarter and searched for you, you know, so it would be debatable. And then the last batch of referrals is, quote, creator driven. I think these are very likely stolen and credited to Kickstarter from other sources. Stolen may be a strong word, but these are all referrals, I think, have a whole lot more to do with the creator's effort than Kickstarter's traffic or discovery platform. This would be like the push notification. So when your project launches, you get this push notification on yourself, on your mobile device or your email that, you know, is like, hey, this project launched. The reason that you receive that is because somebody directed you to the Kickstarter pre-launch page and you clicked notify me on launch. I would agree that that is largely due to what the creator themselves does. If you know, even though I'll give credit to Kickstarter that system exists because Kickstarter made it a thing, they're not really driving traffic to your pre-launch page. You have to drive the traffic to your pre-launch page, and you are 100% credited with all of the followers that you have before a launch happens. Really, one of the things I emphasize as a data guy is I want to make it as simple as possible, eliminate as many variables as possible in order to figure out what information the data is actually conveying. We simplified it even further into two categories, just simply what did Kickstarter raise? And number two, what did the creator raise?
One of the fundamental things that we did differently than what Mike did in his article was that we didn't make a dichotomy, or we didn't split advertising from organic reach. We just clumped that all together. You might reach someone with your ad, but then they might tell their friend. Ideally, what we're trying to work out is how much can we attribute of the overall funds and overall backers to Kickstarter, and then everything else we will basically just clump in as our efforts. And I think that's useful. It helps you understand how effective Kickstarter is as a platform. And then you can leave everything else that you do to your own efforts. Because even essentially, you know, you got to start at the foundation. Like, you have to have a good product. So the Kickstarter won't do anything for you if you just don't have, you know, good art and your game is outstanding. So those things, you know, you have to contribute to all of that to even get Kickstarter going.
There is a margin of error for what it is that we've written. It's not a set in stone. What we're looking at is averages and the preponderance of the evidence. What is the story telling us? Which is why we used multiple clients. In addition to, you know, Mike's campaign, we have four additional campaigns at varying funding levels and also varying levels of, I guess, the time it took them in order to fund.
And one thing that was interesting is that we came across consistent data which you wouldn't expect if there was a huge discrepancy between all of the data. We sort of were getting consistent, you know, obviously percentages here and there, but there was a consistent ratio within all of these campaigns, which leads a very strong argument that what we're actually saying in this article is correct.
So can you talk about the clients that we decided to use, their funding, relative funding amounts, and just any other commentary you might have?
Sure, yeah. So we'll leave this article in the show notes so people can, you know, comb through it. There's quite a lot of information here. We had four of our clients. The first one is Rurikstone and Blade, which had about 3,000 backers and raised $210,000. And that was the most successful campaign that we looked at. I think it funded on the first day, so it was wildly successful. The next one we have is the Board Game Design Starter Kit, which had 1,500 backers, and that raised $72,000. Next is Commission the Call, which is one of our recent projects that is about $50,000. And then we have Fuge, which raised $3,000. So we have a sort of a good spectrum there of different pledge amounts and different backers and different, you know, funding at different times. So we used all that data and we came out with a pretty consistent story.
Let's boil it down. We did a lot of research and a lot of work. People can read about it in the actual article if they want to, which will be in the show notes or on crowdfundingnerds.com. But can you give the cliff notes as to what you found, what the split was, and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Okay. So the spoiler at the end of the day of the article is that not only looking at the data, also looking at what Kickstarter says. So Kickstarter on average says that 60% of the funds is attributed to Kickstarter. That's what they tell us. So when you look at your dashboard, on average, looking at all these different projects, they were saying 60% of the funds was attributed to Kickstarter and 40% was associated with the user and their efforts. And what we found in our data was that was completely on top of its head. It's the exact opposite, where 60% of the funds is consistently through all of these campaigns attributed to the user, whilst 40% is attributed to Kickstarter. This is helpful for you, the listener, because if you look at your campaign, your past campaign, just know that there's about 20% discrepancy that you need to account for. So when you look at your data, you could just take off 20% of what they suggest, and that gives you a better understanding of where you are. I think we should mention as well is that 40% is still a huge amount, which is phenomenal since they only take a 5% commission. So it's a very valuable service. We didn't do this to, you know, rain on the parade of Kickstarter. In fact, we wanted to do this to show our clients and you, the listener, of how effective Kickstarter can be if marketing is done correctly.
And just so that everybody knows, all of these campaigns are board game campaigns. That's something like 38% of Kickstarter's yearly revenue is from board games. And so we love board games. I'm going to talk way too much about board games, I'm sure, on this podcast, and I do to my friends and my coworkers. So the conclusion is that, okay, if the creator brings, you know, is responsible for 60% of the revenue of the backers overall, like on average, and Kickstarter is responsible for 40%, that means that if the creator brings in 6 backers, then Kickstarter is going to bring in 4 backers. So this is not exactly 50-50. You know, if I bring in 5 backers, I expected Kickstarter would bring in 5 backers. That was the assumption I made as a marketer before we did this research. So the idea is that if I bring in 6, then Kickstarter is going to bring in 4 on average. So if my Facebook ads bring in 6 people, then I know Kickstarter will bring in 4. When you're in the middle of a campaign, it's kind of hard to see the forest through the trees, as they say. You are trying to make decisions based on as much information as you have, but there's so much data that's being thrown at you that it's hard to turn that into actionable information. And for me, I would say this is probably the most valuable lesson that we can pull from this conversation, is that if I bring in 6 backers, Kickstarter will bring in 4 more. That's my conclusion. And Rick, you've been a ghost, but you have any thoughts on that?
Definitely. Let's look at the numbers real quick, because that's what I do all day, is just stare at spreadsheets and numbers. Is Kickstarter giving you as many people or backers as you think they are? Most likely not. However, though, there are some exceptions. I have seen some Kickstarters where it's like a guy that makes, this was a little while ago, you know, guys that make dice, you know, for like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff, and they have no mailing list, no nothing, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, I'm 1,000% funded. I think that's definitely Kickstarter doing that, because, you know, it's like eye candy. You know, you're like, oh, that looks really cool. Let me get that. Just like other media platforms, like let's say, you know, hey, follow me on Twitter. Here's my Twitter handle. Well, they're not going to, you know, you're not going to give them a link. They're just going to go on Twitter and put in the handle. So I could see where Kickstarter will say it's a referral in a lot of cases when it's not. But let's just look at the numbers. I mean, even if, like we're saying, even if Kickstarter is giving us 40%, I mean, that's phenomenal. If you launch a successful Kickstarter campaign, it's all covered. You don't have to worry about the expenses, the cost, because Kickstarter is going to bring its own people in, or people who love Kickstarter. They're going to find your product. They're going to like it. They're going to buy it just because they like, you know, funding Kickstarter campaigns. And there you are. So from a number standpoint, I can't see how you would lose. However, though, I know in certain cases, and I know we're going to be talking about this in a little bit, that it may not be the right time for your product to go to Kickstarter, or maybe the product you have is just not Kickstarter worthy. So I'm going to be really excited about this next conversation we're going to talk about. But from a standpoint, you know, if your product is Kickstarter worthy, go for it. I mean, it's right there.
So yeah, let's jump into that discussion. So I kind of alluded to this earlier, is that there have been creators that have come to me in, you know, this last year, or that have been referred to me, or that found us online or something, and they said, hey, you know, can we talk about Kickstarter? And there have been one of two things that I usually do. I don't like to turn people away and not help them. So it's either that I give them a little bit of free advice, I show them maybe where they're not ready, and I give them some homework. And, you know, like, go read this, go, you know, plan that, go, you know, build your email list, or go put your email list together with a website and, you know, that sort of thing about your game. And, you know, people will do that and come back. And I've actually had, you know, that situation happen where I felt like someone wasn't ready, gave them advice, they came back and they were. Then there are other cases where, you know, these are a little bit of the unfortunate cases where I have to find a creative way to say, your product is not ready. It's not tested. You've been in your basement building this game, and you've play tested it with your mom and your dog, and you think that, and your mom said she loved it, but she's not a board gamer, and she's going to back you because she loves you, right? You need people that are going to give you solid feedback that'll tell you the hard things that you might not want to hear. So when somebody comes to me with a product that is clearly not ready, it's not focused, maybe the art is really, really, we'll say, low budget, or maybe they did it themselves, or I don't know, and they're not a great artist, it's kind of hard for me to give the hard news. But it's even harder for me to accept a project like that and then feel bad when I put my head down on my pillow at night thinking, I do not think these guys are going to fund. What am I even doing taking money from these people to market their terrible product? You need to have a solid product that is ready, thoroughly tested, and that kind of thing. Let's talk about that first. There are a couple of different wavelengths we could discuss on this, but let's talk about the actual product itself. Sexy Arishan, you're first.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the product's important, and also understanding what is Kickstarter and who's on Kickstarter, what is the target audience? Because your game that your mom finds fun might just be fine just to play with your family. You know, not every board game that's created has to become this huge, you know, multi-million backed project on Kickstarter. Your game might be fine just to be a game that you play with your friends and family and you find it fun, cool. But it might not work as a commercial product that you can actually sell and make a profit on, especially when board games have such small margins and sort of have to appeal to the largest common denominator. So when it comes to Kickstarter, you have to be very focused and very intentional about what you're doing. Now, we interviewed a lot of people who had backed a lot of campaigns on Kickstarter. This was the consistent thing that we came away with when looking at landing pages, were images, price, gameplay examples, and in that order. So you really have to wow people with your images. Your price has to be, you know, competitive. And you have to have gameplay examples. You have to be able to demonstrate that people can have fun playing this game and that you actually can deliver on what you promise.
Theme, I think, is really important because, you know, you may have this really awesome game that plays very well, but if it's something that no one is interested in, like, I don't know, maybe it's a game about, I don't even know what to think of that. No one would watch.
Cute penguins sliding down an ice chute.
I think kids might like that one though. But anyway.
But are kids the ones on Kickstarter though? That's the problem.
Yeah. So yeah, your average age on Kickstarter for backing is not in the kids zone. However, though, a lot of those people that are backing do have young kids at this time based on their age range. But yeah, theme. You know, like I said, if it doesn't, the theme doesn't procure to the masses, then you're not going to get the masses backing you. I was one of our clients. I was actually a little concerned with because the theme was very, very tight. It was a game with a very it was a specific theme with another like niche on top of that. And I was a little concerned, thinking they may have not funded, but they did. But you know, it was really close. And so, you know, one of the things you need to look into is what are people into these days now? So if you're going to make a board game, you got to see what topics, what things in different genres, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, et cetera. What are people like looking for? You know, we've had the zombie craze for a while. We've had other things like that. What are they looking for? And how can you take your game and theme it that way? What are you guys' thoughts on theme?
I think that that's extremely important. In fact, it makes it a lot easier to market something when I can explain the hook very quickly. So there are certain trends that, you know, it's common knowledge to say you need a hook for your game, the thing that is going to stand out and so on and so forth. That's parroted quite a lot, and for good reason, because that's an important element. And your theme can easily be a hook. We're marketing one game right now, which is a post-apocalyptic giant sandbox game where you control a town. It reminds me of like Book of Eli, the board game. You know, the US is fallen and it's post-apocalypse and whatnot, and you're controlling this town and you're building your town and your influence in the US, and you kind of run into other players and start, you know, having conflict and whatnot. And it's, I mean, the theme alone gets me interested in it because of that post-apocalyptic nature and the city building and, you know, really empire building. I love that, building that engine and that sort of thing. So something like that is a whole lot easier to position when I can envision who would like that, who is interested in that. So, you know, people interested in Fallout or Resident Evil or whatever, you know, post-apocalypse type, you know, experiences. There's a reason that a lot of games are themed zombies, because people are freaking out over The Walking Dead. Or there's a great reason that things are themed fantasy, even though it might be generic fantasy. You know, I mean, people love things like Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and you name it. So those types of things are the things that are easier to position in the marketplace. And so theme for me is kind of important. If your theme is more of like a Euro game, one example that I actually found was pretty difficult to market was Rurik Stone and Blade. This actually ended up being a very successful campaign for us, you know, for the creator piece, you know, and Peacekeeper Games. But I could not get an email lead for them that was under $3. It was quite expensive to get email leads for that campaign. It turned out that 30% of the leads we procured ended up backing the campaign at a higher margin, or at a higher dollar pledge on average than the average for the entire campaign, which was really cool to see. But the theme just wasn't as easy to sell because it had more of a Euro feel. It wasn't as easy to position as a wizard battle where you're dueling wizards or you know, generic fantasy, orcs, elves, goblins. I mean, that's easy, Lord of the Rings fans or whatever, right? So people tend to buy things that they're used to and that they know, and there you go.
Yeah, the danger is that you can niche too far down, where this is a great game, but there's just not enough people who are interested in it to actually make it financially viable. So that's something you got to be quite aware of as well, is that, you know, you and, you know, some of your buddies might find this a really neat game, but there might not be enough other people who share all of those very specific interests. So that's very important when thinking about game design.
That's really a question of target market. And really, the target market is extremely important, probably a topic for another podcast. But I will say that the adage goes, riches are in niches. That is very true. Every time you kind of divert off of a popular theme, a common theme, you know, zombies or fantasy or whatever, pirates is kind of, you know, being a thing now. Every time you divert, you risk finding, you know, what you just said, where there are not that many people interested in this thing right now. But on the opposite side of the coin, you could find an audience that is starved for a game like that, that is much bigger than others have been giving it credit for. So as a marketing agency, like as kind of the fearless leader of a marketing agency, what I do is I tend to rely more on the creator's view of things when I feel that they are prepared for Kickstarter. I will abdicate to their wisdom because, you know, if I don't see it, it doesn't mean that it's not true. And the creator may very well have insight that I don't. And so if they believe in their product, a lot of the time, that's something that can actually sell me on taking them as a client. Whereas if the theme is a little bit generic or you know, hard to position, so we had a client that had that was super excited about sloths, like loved sloths. A guy from Iceland, really awesome dude, really interesting game, kind of a family-oriented, unstable unicorns type game. And I was like, man, who's interested in sloths, you know? And the guy's belief in himself and in his product really convinced me. And of course, he funded a very successful Kickstarter campaign. He ended up getting the Exploding Kittens Company to back his campaign, and he has funded pretty well for himself. And that was all because he had insight that we didn't. We managed to get a lot of email leads and do a lot of the pre-marketing work and that kind of thing. And that was something that every once in a while completely surprises me. The segue into your belief in your product is very important to share with me as a marketer. So if people don't really believe in their product, then you're not quite ready for Kickstarter. Let's see, what other things, you know, other than let's you know, get this one out in the open real quick, is non-professional. If your art is not up to par, then you will have a bad showing. If your Kickstarter page is filled, or your landing page before Kickstarter is filled with spelling mistakes, people are going to have a harder time believing that you can actually deliver a product, that you can master the logistical challenges in front of you, that you can survive them. I know we work for a lot of people that are very great business owners and also extremely dyslexic, and they have other people that can check their work and things like that. So there are a lot of ways to get around that. The last element would be if it just is not ready, if you don't have art, if your game is a drawing on a napkin, really, I would say your game has to be like 60% done or more so that you can show off a finished game. I would say 9 out of 10 people are very visual. They look at a product and say, you know, a Kickstarter project and say, that is the product that I am receiving. And they can't envision that it's part of the product. It's what the product's going to look like, a shade of what it's going to look like, but it's actually going to be way cooler. You know, if I show you a black and white drawing and tell you that it's going to be colorized, all you're seeing is the black and white drawing. You can't, a lot of people cannot envision the color in the black and white drawing. So if you're asking for money for something that doesn't look finished, then you're going to have a much harder time getting people to convert. So you can have a lot of people that are really excited about a campaign, and then when you actually launch, all the people that said they were excited, nobody backs. Or, you know, you've got an email list of 1,000 people, 2,000 people, and you get, you know, 10% funded your first day. It's because maybe the product didn't look ready.
And sometimes you only get one chance to impress people. So if you put things on the back burner, say, okay, we'll come back, we'll turn to it and improve it, well, you might not get a second chance with a prospect. So you really want to always put your best foot forward. And sometimes it's better not to release anything at all than to release something that's half-baked or not entirely finished. So you have to remember as well is that people have very short attention spans. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of money in this space where people can throw at, you know, very professional looking art. So if you don't have that money to invest in, you know, quality illustrators or graphic design artists, what's going to set your game apart from them? And focus on your strengths and always put your best foot forward.
Right. That's actually a huge element, the money. You know, long gone are the days that you can bring an idea to Kickstarter. You have to spend a lot of money in order to get your product ready for raising money, which sounds kind of backwards, but you know, the truth is that Kickstarter has matured quite a lot, and Cards Against Humanity raised $14,000 back, you know, in the day. And now it honestly, it might not even fund. It's the type of product that is, you know, an incredible success story, but you know, it only made $14,000 on Kickstarter, you know, or $12,000 or something. You need to have the budget to, number one, to market your product. You can't go to Kickstarter with an email list of 50 people and expect that you're going to fund reliably or overfund. It is possible. I've seen it happen, but you're not giving yourself great chances. So if you don't have the money to invest, number one, into the quality of your art and the, you know, prototyping of your game, and maybe, you know, I know it's 2020 and so we're all locked in our bunkers, but, you know, before that, driving to conventions and showing off your game in person, if you don't have the resources to do those things, you're not properly prepared for Kickstarter. What we're talking about here isn't the minimum viable entry point. What I'm talking about is, if you want your product to have its greatest chance of success, if you want it to thrive, if you want it to do the absolute best that it can possibly do, then you need to have a budget and you need to have a plan and you need to actually invest more up front. So that's kind of the harsh reality, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. In fact, that leads over to one of my little pet peeves I have. As a Kickstarter consumer, one of my biggest pet peeves is pledge packages. So as a designer of a board game or whatever you're designing, I think a lot of these people sometimes don't do the research needed or look into, what needs to be done or what the expectation is of how much like their game is worth. And sometimes I'll sit there and I'll go to a game and I'll be like, whoa, you know, that's, it's a really cool game, but they're asking for like four times the amount of money that someone else is asking, and I can get four cool games for the cost of one. Or you'll look at something and you're just like, how did they determine that? And so I think for me as a consumer on Kickstarter, I feel that, you know, once you feel like you have your solid product, you've done your research and stuff, do more research and see what people are paying for that type of product to make sure you're matching your pledge levels with that.
Absolutely. And speaking of research, that is another component. If you are not prepared with a level of understanding of what to expect on the road in front of you when you launch a product on Kickstarter, you know, I like to tell people, have a plan for if you fail. Number one, if you fail. Number two, if you have a moderate success, let's say 117% funded, and then a product for, you know, great success, like 300-500% funded, and then a plan. And then a plan for catastrophic success. That would be like 10 times or 100 times what you had hoped that you would raise. I have seen companies at all of these benchmarks totally screw up. I've seen people raise $500,000, $1.5 million and more that have failed to deliver. And actually, statistically, the higher dollar value a crowdfunding campaign makes, the less likely they will actually deliver on that campaign, which is a little bit scary. But the more profitable a campaign looks, the more logistical challenges, the greater opportunity for mismanagement of those funds. And so you, as a creator, you really need to do your research. I mean, there are a lot of great places to go. KickstarterLessons.com, that's Jamie Stegmaier's list of lessons. There are like 300 of them now. BoardGameDesignLab.com is an excellent resource for things like that. You really need to have these lessons in your head. You can't just go to Kickstarter assuming, or rather, I implore you not to go to Kickstarter and just say, I'm just going to wing it.
I think one of the great things about Kickstarter is that if you do have a hit, if you do have a game, Kickstarter has every financial incentive to get that game to as many people and get as many pledges as possible, which distinguishes it from the other crowdfunding platforms. Because of its all or nothing system, Kickstarter has a financial incentive to get your game funded. So that's very attractive. If you do have a product that is in huge demand, it's going to blow up in Kickstarter.
Definitely. It, like you said, your interest and their interests are aligned because they want to get their cut. And so, of course, the more successful you are, the more successful they are. And yeah, like you said, I've seen these Kickstarter campaigns just blow up like crazy, because the better your campaign does, the higher you rank on the Kickstarter homepage, or get there at least. And then once you get on that page, it's like boom, 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 boom. Everyone who loves Kickstarter but doesn't particularly know your product, where this is where Kickstarter referrals come in, they'll start, you know, avalanching. So, you know, I could see how, like, you know, on average Kickstarter referrals are about 40%, but in rare cases where you have like an extreme awesome product, I think it could be much higher. Especially like I was saying, like with the people that in the past that made acrylic dice for games, I've seen some like crazy beautiful dice out there, and they had no marketing, no mailing lists, and they literally like they 10 times, you know, their funding within days. Definitely. Kickstarter is interested in everything and anything, even if your product may not be right for them, they will always do their best to get you going.
Yeah, you know, I will mention that anytime somebody goes to Kickstarter without much of a following or, you know, that kind of thing, and then their product blows up, there are many that, you know, examples that we can cite. A lot of people are probably familiar with examples like Exploding Kittens, just a huge, huge project that kind of came out of nowhere. They didn't start from square one, but man, did it blow up way larger than the audience that they brought with them, right? And there are, again, many other examples of that. Frosthaven is the most recent one. I mean, $12.8 million. They reached $5 million in one day. And I do not think that that was because of the strength of their email list and that kind of thing. There was a lot of hype, a lot of organic hype that they had no control over. All they had was a great product that people were excited about. And yes, Kickstarter does have a significant amount of organic traffic. You know, we call it Kickstarter Tuesday for a reason. A lot of projects launch on Tuesday. There's more organic traffic on Kickstarter on Tuesday because for board games, especially because of that whole phenomenon of, you know, Wisdom launch on Tuesday, but I don't want to diminish the value of organic marketing effort that happens. I would say that half of a good campaign's marketing is actually by the backers themselves. So, you know, I mean, we can, you know, spend money on ads and here and there and everywhere. You can have a great email list and all of that. But if you want your campaign to spin out of control into a viral success, then it will only happen because people tell other people. You know, you have only so many hours in a day that you can personally invest. But if you have, you know, 3,000 backers, 5,000 backers or whatever from a previous campaign, like Gloomhaven, I think had like 10 or 12,000, I can't remember, off of their second printing. And so they had a lot of buzz ready to go for Frosthaven. Again, it kind of comes back to the product. If the product is a really outstanding thing that people want, your job is to expose it, and their job is to do the rest.
All right, nerds, it looks like we are running out of time for this podcast. But before we go, I just want to get some quick last minute tips from Sean and Andrew. And then let's see where it goes. Sean, real quick.
I think one important thing to keep in mind is that the demand for board games is increasing on an annual basis. You can actually look at the successful games funded on Kickstarter, and it's increasing year by year. Now, we have information, articles we've produced on crowdfundingnerds.com, which you can check out, some of these metrics and some of these things. But you need to keep in mind that Kickstarter might be in its infancy. We never know where this is going. We don't know how big the board gaming industry will eventually become. It is increasing, and that's very exciting for game designers and for entrepreneurs who want to make it big on Kickstarter. That is becoming more and more of a reality for many people around the world.
Absolutely. And I'll add from my little element that I find an event like the coronavirus that causes so much of a behavior change, a lot of people get afraid and they stop advertising, they pull their campaign and that kind of thing. Well, I'll go back to Frosthaven and said Frosthaven launched at the height of the coronavirus panic in April. I believe they launched April Fool's Day or close to it, April 1st. The idea is that whatever you think is conventional wisdom, sometimes, you know, doing the opposite rewards you substantially. And what I find is that it is very difficult to tell. You know, I was running a Kickstarter campaigns back in March, and I did see a significant drop off in the week, you know, between March 16th through the 21st or 2nd or something. We lost like half of our average daily backers or more for each of our campaigns that we were running. And then a week later, they kind of recovered. And I actually found April, May were some of the strongest months for Kickstarter campaigns this entire year. It was weird. You know, it turns out that, you know, what you would expect to have happen was that everybody would get really tight on their wallets. And it turns out that people just spent all their money on Kickstarter stuff. So be willing to do more and to not necessarily follow conventional wisdom. That's kind of my lesson I want to leave everyone this week.
Just for me, I think my view on this is now is the time. A Kickstarter, especially board games, are exploding like crazy. And personally, if you got something, you know, get passionate about it, work on it, and get it out there. And of course, we're always around too to help you out as well. In fact, if you guys have any questions about crowdfunding, please feel free to shoot us a message, and you can reach us at crowdfundingnerds.com/questions. And what we'll do is we'll do our best to respond to your questions in a timely manner, as well as you possibly maybe your question may be featured on a future podcast. Also, we've talked about a lot of things today, and we have a lot of resources that you weren't able to see through the podcast. However, we'll have them all available on our website as well at crowdfundingnerds.com/episode1. So I really want to thank you guys for making this inaugural episode phenomenal. And we look forward to seeing you at the next episode.
Live long and prosper.
Adios.
Catch you guys later.